a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spirko with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday, beginning with the oldest of them and going forward. There's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years, so sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And today, folks, we are flashing back to August the 9th, 2011. This was originally episode 720. I'm sorry, 720. That didn't sound right. 720. It was an interview with Jason Fields of a group called the Urban Farming Guys. These folks were doing some amazing stuff in Kansas City, Missouri. And completely changing the dynamic in a lower class neighborhood where houses were largely condemned. They dropped the crime rate just by showing up and did a lot of other really great things. I don't know how active they still are in that place. They were up till a few years ago. They're not very active online anymore. They are now not really posting anything. Haven't since about the beginning of the COVID crisis is when they seem to have stopped really posting a lot of material. But this was a great interview. And they were clearly active for at least 10 years after we did this interview. So it wasn't something that was like a flash in the pan and blew away. And they still have a tremendous, and I mean a tremendous, library of wisdom in their YouTube channel. So, like in all of these, I do continue to put links back to the original episode where all of the resources were. But directly into today's show notes, I included a link to their YouTube channel because I think that's probably the most valuable thing that they have for you still today. Anyway, this is an inspiring episode. A great one to go into a weekend with, and I will catch you on Monday with more. Remember, we do have the Cover Crop and Soils course for sale now at homefoodsystems.com. MSB members get a full $15 off the price of that course. It's $80 for everybody else. People have been buying it over the past couple days. We're still in a soft launch. More details will come on it on Monday, but if you want to get it before anybody else, then get working on it so you can get your cover crops in this fall. Which is a great time to do it, is right now. You want to get your hands on this course as quickly as possible. Again, it's at homefoodsystems.com. All right, folks, and as I said during the introduction segment, I'm really excited about today's show. I've been trying to connect with these guys, and I think the Internet has conspired against us for a couple of months because they've been happy to come on, and I've been wanting to bring them on. But I've got one of many of the urban farming guys on the line with me today, Mr. Jason Fields, and he's going to tell me about and tell you guys about what the urban farming guys are doing. And those of you who have seen their YouTube channel and their blog, as I've put it out on the show quite a few times, are probably pretty excited to hear from them, too. Hey, Jason, welcome to the Survival Podcast.
Hey, Jack. We love what you guys are about. It's an honor to be on the show with you.
Well, I'm really glad to have you here. I mean, the first thing I ever saw you guys do on YouTube, somebody sent me a video where you guys, it was like your intro video, your first one, where you were just talking about what you're doing, and then I saw your biogas project, and I was like, I got to get these guys on the show. But for those maybe who haven't seen your channel or your blog yet, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Who are the urban farming guys?
Yeah, the Urban Farming Guys is a network of pioneers, people from all walks of life, all around the globe, who are passionate about sustainability and sustainable community. And at the core of the Urban Farming Guys is something very special you've seen in the videos. It's a living example of real people. We call it the Urban Experiment, except it's not really an experiment. It's more our whole life. Over the last 10 years, 20 plus families have uprooted from suburbia and planted themselves in the inner city of Kansas City, each family buying a home within a 5-block radius of each other in one of the most blighted, bombed out, really, zip codes in the U.S. Just every other house is pushed over. And these are people who believe that big government is not the solution, but taking personal responsibility for the youth and the poor is the only sustainable way to lift our city up from the core, from the inside out. And the major task is to rebuild with no funding, no programs, no schools to send our kids to. Really, we're just working on dirt and passion. And we're seeing huge results. We've just in the last 2 years, we've seen a 21% reduction in major crimes in the Likens neighborhood. In the 10-block by 10-block area, we get crime results. And those crime results should be going up with the economy, and they're actually coming significantly down. So it's been an incredible journey.
Yeah, I mean, I've been watching your videos and stuff and reading your blog posts, and I didn't really get until we started exchanging by email and getting some material together for the show how many of you folks there were. I kind of looked at it as like there's maybe one or two families there, but you've got 20 in the young families too. These aren't, you know, older folks that are giving back. You guys are young, energetic people that are deciding you're going to make something happen. How did the 20 of you guys find each other? What brought you all together into this place of, you know, it really is a blighted area. I know exactly where you're talking about. There's certain areas and certain cities I don't want to go to in Kansas City, New Orleans, and a few other places spring to mind. And you guys went there and you're just hitting it, you know, and making something happen. What got you guys kind of grouped together? What drove this in the beginning?
Yeah, it's, you just don't get 20 families to just decide one day to move down into the urban core. It's really been a slow trickle with this particular group. It started out 10 years ago in the burbs, actually, out in Olathe, with a guy who told his church, you know, we've got to put our money where our mouth is. And this guy, Tim Johns, he bought a property down here that's now a block away from my house down here in the inner city. And it's just been a slow trickle after that. I actually ran into Tim Johns 7 years ago, total stranger at this coffee shop. And I was just writing down the vision. I just knew I had to move down to the inner city and give my life away for, you know, this cause. And he's over there talking to some other guy across the way, saying the exact things that I'm writing down in my journal. And I'm like, I got to go introduce myself. So I went over there and talked to him. And within a month, I had rented a place down here in the inner city about 7 years ago on the block. And, you know, about 4 years ago, you know, three or four really cool families moved down. You know, since then I've been married, and my wife and I purchased a house down here that was just completely dilapidated on a huge piece of property because there were several houses that got pushed over. And we totally redid that. I mean, we got this giant house here for $20,000. And we're hitting kind of a critical mass now where, you know, we're at 20 plus families, and we just, the last 2 weekends, have moved in two more families into houses that just closed. And last night I was just renovating a buddy of mine's house, three houses down. He got that for 10 grand. It was just totally, totally wrecked, but we're going to totally turn that thing around. So,
I mean, that's just pretty amazing. And I talk an awful lot at times on the show about getting out of the cities, you know, and I always say though, but if that's where you want to be, if that's the kind of community you want, then make the most of it. Sounds like you guys are really doing that. And I also think part of like why you guys are seeing the crime rate drop and all is if you move enough good people into an area, the work that they do and the stability that they provide starts to level things off. I mean, have you started to like see a lot more interest on the people that were already there before you came there though in what you're doing and saying, yeah, show us what you're doing and are they getting involved with you guys or is it just mainly your group kind of as an island or is it like an island that's branching out?
Absolutely. You know, down here, it's not a us and them thing. We've slid in here so organically that you can't tell the difference between us. We are one with the neighborhood. We have come in and we've served the neighborhood association. You know, when we came in, it hardly existed, but we got behind the president here and his ideas. And we just, it's not two groups. It's really one. We're all neighbors here. And, man, it's been absolutely incredible. It's really not that hard. One of the biggest problems with the urban core is fear, where people are afraid, so they shut their window. They turn down the curtains, and right next door, there's all sorts of stuff going on, you know, prostitution, drug dealing, intimidation, stuff that is so easy to get rid of. You know, if you're willing to just walk down the street and look people in the eye, we've got rid of two drug dealers next door in the last year and a half, and it was so simple. What's really changed this neighborhood around is having people willing to have eyes on the street. My wife and I have made a point to walk wherever we go right here in the neighborhood. It's just, you know, we talk about 21% decrease in crime. That's in a 10 by 10 block radius. Right here on these two streets here, Myrtle and Norton, it's probably 85%. It went from a war zone. I mean, right after I moved in to the urban core 7 years ago, you know, I looked out my office window and, you know, there's gunshots and the gun's pointing right at me. Two guys are wrestling in the street and guy shot the other guy in the leg. Just a whole different scenario now. You know, I imagine in 5 years, people are going to come down here and be like, what do you mean the urban core? This is, you know, this is a nice area.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, paraphrasing here, but I believe the old quote is that evil is rampant when good men do nothing. Right. And it sounds like when good men at least just pay attention, that alone has a massive effect.
Huge effect. Absolutely.
Cool. Well, I want to talk a little bit about some of the projects you're doing. One of the things I'm keenly interested in setting up at my homestead is an aquaponics system. So I was looking at the way you guys are doing it, and I was kind of leaning toward the whole flush and drain, grow bed type scenario. It looks like you guys are more doing like a kind of the deep water thing with the floating stuff. And tell us a little bit about your aquaponics setup, because I want to know, and I know the audience wants to know.
Yeah, one of the things we're really passionate about is sustainable technologies and, you know, appropriate technology. One thing that's really appropriate around here is just to be able to find found materials. We live really close to a scrapyard. And it's actually one of the bigger problems in the neighborhood, but we've turned that around and made it positive and been able to find just found materials. We a couple things we had to get on Craigslist, but the idea is to find, you know, stuff that you would spend $400 or $500 on for $25, you know, $30. So we've been using these IBC totes, the 275-gallon tanks. We found a way to hook six of them up in a series, so we're able to have 2,000 gallons of water. So we, right in a really small space, about the size of your living room, we're growing 1,000 fish right there in this system where you don't have to, all the water gets recirculated using aquaponic technology. We're pumping the fish water through the filtration system that we built out of 55-gallon drums up to the plants, and the plants are doing the last stage of filtration and sending the water back basically clean. And producing a lot of, the fish are producing a lot of organic fertilizer for us to send out to the garden.
Yeah, because you're going at a higher density than most people do with aquaponics systems, where generally the plants and the media provide enough conversion of nitrite to nitrate and filtration and nutrient uptake by the plants that you don't have to remove anything. But you guys are almost every day getting a bucket of fish poo, basically, out of the bottom of, you have like, I think you call it a cyclone filter going on. But that is allowing you to kind of take up the production level. Now I got to ask you this. What do you guys do with 1,000 fish a year? That's a lot of fish. Is that just to feed, you know, like a sharecropping thing with these 20 families? Or are you guys actually turning that into some level of a local revenue model now? Or that's a lot of fish. I'm looking to produce like 100 a year for me and my wife, you know, and maybe some friends and some barter. What are you guys doing with 1,000?
Yeah, I imagine we're going to get sick of fish after a while. But, yeah, we've done a lot of things like that where there's just a lot of efficiency down here where instead of spending a whole month or two to build a chicken coop, we team up with a couple families who are interested and say, hey, let's do this project together. You know, split the cost, bust it out, knock it out, and, you know, we'll split the reward. And so now instead of having to go out to the chicken coop every single day, you know, we only go out 3 days out of the seven and, you know, water the chickens and we split the eggs.
Sure.
Same with fish. You know, we'll split them up between a few families who have really invested in this project. But really, it's a proof of concept. We're doing 1,000 fish to prove that we can go do 10,000 fish in a much, much larger system. And the whole idea behind that is to build a sustainable nonprofit farm so that rather than relying on grant money and other things, we want to build our everything we do around the ability to pay for it ourselves. Although we're a long way off and we could use some, you know, some startup cash. Sure. It would go a long way. But yeah, we don't want to have to rely on grants that we don't know are going to be there in 2 years. So.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I think that if you can expand it enough, you can eventually get it into, like you're saying, where it's self-sufficient, not just from an input standpoint, but from a financial standpoint as well. Eventually you have a yield that can turn. Maybe it's a non-profit, but it's a sustainable cash flow that basically gets reinvested to continue to expand the project. And that can be a big part of rehabbing the neighborhood in and of itself.
Absolutely. It's run totally like a business. You know, we use the word nonprofit, but it's totally after the bottom line to get the money back into the nonprofit to reinvest into the neighborhood.
Now, what do you guys do to, like, support yourselves? I mean, have you guys just, like, cut your expenses to so little that you know, do you guys have full-time jobs? Is there enough in this to support yourselves with? How do you manage to, you know, live on a daily basis?
Yes. Yeah, we are all about simplicity. Whatever we can cut, just the idea of moving into a house that, you know, is a third of the expense you would have out in the suburbs is a huge deal, especially for young families. So we're cutting our cost. We're making it simple. We're not having to work overtime at our jobs. We do, almost all of us have 9-to-5 jobs. I personally built a lawn care landscape business over a 10-year period and sold it, which bought me some time to really launch some of this web stuff off and tell the story and get it out there. But, yeah, eventually we're going to build this thing up to where we can hire a farm manager, hire me on as a farm manager, run that until we can, you know, hire somebody to take my place and keep pushing forward.
See, and I think that's so important because I see a lot of people that get into these community projects and they do it all with charity money or all with grant money, and they say, I don't want to make any money at all. I don't want any kind of salary at all. And to me, the problem with that is you're trying to build a sustainable agricultural system, a sustainable community, but you're doing it without a sustainable machine.
Right.
And we have to be able to feed ourselves and clothe ourselves and do things like that. And we can do a lot from the land, but there are certain things in our society that, you know, money necessitates. If nothing else, the property taxes on these 20 houses have to be paid. So I think it's really great that you're doing that. I want to talk about another one of your projects now, though, the biogas. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you're doing that and specifically what you're doing to create like a pressure containment system so that it can be stored and used?
Absolutely. We are we built the biogas thing for a few reasons. One, there's just an excess of rotten food that just goes to the landfill around here. There's probably 25 Mexican restaurants in the neighborhood, and we want to find ways to power our greenhouse. We're growing fish and plants year-round. And with biogas, potentially we can produce enough biogas to heat a water heater, to heat the water, to heat the greenhouse. And, you know, our prototype here, just by heating the water, our air temperature in the greenhouse this whole winter never got below 48. And we've got 4,000 gallons of liquid in this little tiny greenhouse, which is like a heat sink. There's no spikes. Even when it was down, you know, -5, it was still 48 degrees inside. So the idea is to heat the water with the biogas. You put the rotten vegetables in. They churn around just like your stomach. They produce methane gas, and you harvest that off, and you've got to store it somehow. One of the ways we're looking at storing it is by putting tractor trailer tubes in series. So, and you know, with a little check valve, if one of them popped, the rest of them wouldn't pop. And another way we showed in the video is just by gravity, the gravity of the upper tank. You'd have to see the video, but the gravity of the upper tank sitting in the water of the lower tank, it lifts up as the methane's bubbled underneath it. It lifts up. And then as it's used, the weight of the tank pressurizes it back into your house, into your cook stove, into your water heater, whatever you're using for. We bought a generator recently. We're going to probably do a video on how to redo the carburation so it can burn methane.
That's awesome. I want to put you guys and Stephen Harris together. He's kind of a guru of all things alternative energy and biogas and wood gasification and all this stuff. But we had him on recently. He was talking about a system like you're talking about with your biogas, And the way that he said to up the pressure on that double barrel system where you have one on top of the other is if you need more pressure, just throw another brick on top of the one on the top and it'll up your pressure. And I was talking about, you know, measuring the pressure and all. He said, go light the burner. And if the burner doesn't burn hot enough, throw another brick on there until it does, and you know you got your pressure right. And I think that's what I like about him, and I like about what you guys are doing. You're taking simplistic solutions to complex problems.
Yeah, I'd love to meet that guy.
Yeah, like I said, I think they'll give a little matchmaking for you guys. I think you guys could really help each other out quite a bit. I also wanted to kind of to talk to you a little bit about, I've seen all these videos about what you're doing, but what are you guys growing outside of the greenhouse, outside of it? Because I know you're taking all this big slurry of fish fertilizer every day, and I mean, how many gardens are we talking about? What kind of production? What are you guys growing?
Yeah, our gardens are kind of three-part. Just to walk the talk, all of us have got gardens in our backyard, but you know, for our own personal use, but our together collectively we purchased 13 lots, and we've got three more donated from Land Trust right here together in the neighborhood. You'll find these areas that used to have houses on them, but now you've got 13 lots right next to each other that are totally vacant. So we picked those up, and it's the start of our nonprofit urban farm, and we're picking up more all the time, where we're growing vegetables potentially to go to market. These plots of land were totally overrun with trees and trash, and it was just a breeding ground for drugs and prostitution. It's been an immediate drop in crime. We just purchased these within the last year. So if you could see what's been done on some of the videos and pictures, it's just been incredible what's happened in 1 year to clean up that block. And now we're growing just any kind of vegetable you could think of. It's a learning process for all of us, and some of us are more seasoned than others. But there's two parts. There's a community garden where we've taken and we built these raised beds, 12 by 4 foot beds, and we've knocked on everybody's door and said, hey, you know, would you like to adopt one of these gardens? And, you know, it doesn't cost anything. We put the soil in it, we build it, but it's your responsibility. If, you know, you water it, you weed it, we're going to put a plaque with your name on it, a little positive peer pressure, and it's your deal, your produce. And if they do good with it, we'll give them another garden. And it's really served well to gel our neighborhood together. Now, neighbors who would be, you know, holed up in their homes, afraid to talk to anybody, are now out gardening with us and getting to know, and now we're sharing information. It's just really been, and now the kids that are gardening with them, we've given them a plot. Now they're hanging out at our after-school art program, and now there's a village feel happening where instead of, you know, an isolated feel to the neighborhood. So it's three parts. It's our backyards, it's a community garden, and then the start of a nonprofit urban farm.
You know, would you say that the people that have started to do this have like a new sense of pride and a new sense of ownership in the community?
Absolutely. Without a... had to let my dog out. Absolutely.
Okay. No worries.
There's just a huge growth in pride. We actually called the program Cultivate Dignity. We don't tell them that. But that's what we want to do. Rather, you know, we're not against food pantries and giving food away. We actually have done that quite a bit. But what we'd rather do is teach people to feed themselves. And, you know, it's just a 12 by 4 foot garden. But that little bit of education and, you know, them realizing that this is something I can do, then it turns out to be their whole backyard. And even the Department of Agriculture has been calling us up and saying, hey, keep going, guys. This is awesome. If we can just teach people to do this themselves, it can change the local economy.
And how much production? I mean, I'm sure everybody has different things, plants different things, has different levels of care, but how much food do you say on average, if a person really puts a little bit of effort into it, you can produce out of a 12 by 4 foot piece of land?
Yeah, there's lots of numbers. I mean, when you're doing the square foot gardening, you can really, and you're doing the vertical gardening, you can increase your production. You know, standard average for farmers is, you know, 11,000 pounds per acre, which is not even a, you know, a pound a square foot, or not even a fourth of that. But I think you can do well over that. I don't have that number off the top of my head, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's significant. I mean, the big thing is that it's enough that once you get into the main part of the growth season, people can pretty much eat, you know, like a small family can eat something out of there every day all the way through the growing season. That's what I've always found. I'm less concerned about the total pounds per square foot and more concerned about the fact that even something small like that from the time it's warm enough to work to the ground until it freezes over, you can eat something almost every day that you've produced yourself.
Yeah, and we're planting three crops, and we've got an abundance of fish fertilizer and chicken manure. It's just, you know, we plant our spring crop, and then we turn around and plant our summer crop and again in the fall. So,
what, like, this, I mean, this all sounds great, but I imagine as you've been doing this, there's been some really significant obstacles along the way, some real challenges. Could you tell us about some of those things?
Man, it's been hard, but well worth it. I mean, any one of us who has started out as an idealist has quickly changed their mind moving down here. You know, right after I move in, a guy's broken in my truck in the backyard, and that's a story for you. I grab the totally wrong weapon. I grab an axe right by the back door and run out there, and I'm yelling, "Get out of my truck!" And he doesn't hear me until I'm standing right on top of him, and he freaks out. He drops his cell phone, drops everything he stole from the last guy, and you know, I had mercy on him. I backed up and I said, "Get going." And I jumped in the car and followed him from a distance, and we got him arrested. And the hard part is I show up to the courtroom, you know, thinking I can talk to the prosecutor and we could do customer or community service, and I could do half of his time with him and, you know, try to make a difference. And nobody shows up to court. There were 70 people on the docket, and only one lawyer showed up and one guy. The rest of them didn't give a rip. You know, they didn't care that they had a warrant on, because there's no beds in the jail. So,
well, they also probably are, the guy's probably got four or five warrants already. So what does he care about another one?
What's he care?
Yeah.
So we've had troubles, you know, and we've taken care of a lot of them. We had a real trouble with scrap metal. When I bought my house, it was completely tore apart. All the electrical wires that were tore out, all the copper, everything. And I meet the guy at the front door. He's pushing a shopping cart. You know, I'm looking to buy this house. And he says, you know, I said, I was just bold enough to see, you know, this is the third time I came by my house and he was standing right in front. So I just wanted to see what I was getting into. I said, "Hey, are you going to take that shopping cart back when you're done with it?" And he goes, "No, this is one of 243 models, you know, discontinued models that I've cut up and scrapped." And he says, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm looking at this house." And he goes, "Well, I'll tell you anything you want to know about this house. It's got the radiator stolen out of it, the copper stolen out of it. You know, my job in this neighborhood is to bring down the property values," he said.
Wow.
Well, that little soundbite traveled like wildfire through the police department and through the, you know, the neighborhood meetings. And I went to a neighborhood meeting and shared it with a local community action network officer. And that thing spread so fast that it got back around to him. And the next time I saw him, he goes, "Oh, you show up to the community meetings, don't you? I heard what you know." Anyway, he got arrested 14 times in a row. Like every single day they were arresting him for just walking in the street. He finally found a new neighborhood to give trouble to. So,
wow. Yeah. What I also want to know is, have you guys had any kind of like direct resistance, like people that just don't want you there or, you know, anything like that?
We've really just found a lot of the neighbors are just love us. We're, direct resistance. You know, I think a lot of drug dealers, it's just more profitable to move on.
Yeah.
They just find another neighborhood. I ran into this guy at Quick Trip out in Raytown, about, you know, 15 miles from here. And I overheard him say to his friend, "Hey, why don't you go back up to the Northeast and move in with your sister?" And he goes, "Oh, man, it's too hot in the Northeast. Too hot." So it's just not profitable here to sell drugs.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, that's a big thing that people are concerned of. If they try to do an initiative similar to what you're doing, that they're going to have all this reprisal. But I've learned in a society there's a certain percentage of us that are going to be scum, and they just are, and they want to live that way. But they're lazy. That's what, part of why they're that way. So like water, they'll take the path of least resistance, and it's easier to relocate and start peddling your dope somewhere where no one cares. And I think that's why you get the area, like you're saying, like the results you've seen are simply because people actually care. As soon as people care, and as soon as people are going to stand up, as soon as people pay attention, it's like light and darkness. They cannot coexist for long, and the darkness flees.
It's true. And you got to be smart about it somewhat. You know, every now and then I'll see a guy walk into a backyard, and if I'm with my family, I'm not going to run up and, you know, expose my family. But if I'm alone, heck yeah, I'm running back there and say, hey, what are you doing back here in this yard?
Mm-hmm.
This is not your yard. And they move on.
It's interesting how quick a lot of people will back down. There is a danger, though, and you're very smart to not put your family at risk in that situation. It's one thing to risk yourself. It's another thing to risk, you know, your kids or your wife. Can you tell us about maybe some of the other projects you're working on?
Yeah, we've just got a heck of a deal from the city a few years back and got this old school building with seven classrooms and a gymnasium and a cafeteria. You know, we pulled our money together and found a way to pay that thing off. It's still, you know, still a lot of work to do. We've renovated the gymnasium, and now we've got some of the boys in the neighborhood wrestling in there. And this is their second year wrestling, and now they're starting to win some matches. It's really fun. So we got the nonprofit urban farm. We're building up this school building. We really don't have a place to send our kids to school, so we're winging it. We're doing homeschool. We're probably end up doing a co-op and evolve into a charter school. But we really want to, rather than put ourselves in a bubble, you know, we want to scholarship some of these kids in the neighborhood, or, you know, draw a boundary and really build this village here.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, that's a huge part, is that if kids grow up and they don't get a solid education, and I could go on for an hour about how that doesn't happen in a lot of places in America, even with the flawed nature of the educational system as it is, there's still places where it's pretty good, and there's some places where it's abysmal. So if you can kind of skin that cat at the same time you're doing all this other stuff, it's not just about empowering the current generation, but enlightening the future one. And the other thing is that the problem in a lot of these decayed areas is the kids that are good kids, that despite the odds stay good, that work their butts off, that get the education however they can get it and get themselves into a university or a college or get a trade, they leave because they don't feel like there's anything there for them. And, right. You know, the other side of this is if you can build the community where they don't want to leave, and, you know, because it is an inner city area, there's the other parts of the city around. So there's, even if they don't want to do the stuff you're doing, there is opportunity there for them. So that's kind of like a really holistic approach you guys are taking. So this school you guys got donated, is that destined to be this charter school, or is it going to be like a community center? What's its final thing look like that we eventually get to with it?
It'll be an evolution. The big thing is the kids. These kids are, by the time they hit 13, their biggest opportunity is in the gang. You know, that's their only opportunity, and we want to turn that around. We want to build their resume. We want to have we want to build a, you know, community cafe, build some entrepreneurial things that they can, you know, do some job training, eventually get their first job and be able to go out into the marketplace and do well. There's a lot of skills they don't pick up at home. So, but yeah, eventually a school, if we have to start out building a community cafe and do some entrepreneurial stuff in the building first to get there, then we'll do that, and we'll probably grow out of that school eventually.
Very cool. And I mean, you guys are trying to kind of do this all on your own, but I imagine you guys could use some help as well. Is there any way people from the Survival Podcast community could provide you with some help?
Yeah, Jack, thanks for asking, man. A lot of the inertia has started. The ball's rolling. Our whole idea is to empower people across the globe to do some of this themselves. And then there's this neighborhood here. We've run the numbers. What does it cost to create a job, to get this thing rolling? Because once it's rolling, it rolls itself. We start creating more jobs with the income brought in, and you know, and we're not waiting on the money to do it. But an influx of cash will cause an explosion in a good way here. So that's one thing. The other thing is just, you know, follow the story, inspire others, share the videos.
Very cool. I'll tell you, I just found your donate button and set up to give you a donation of $10 a month, and definitely endorse with what you're doing. So anybody else out there wants to consider doing that, you can find that on the urbanfarmingguys.com, and I think it's definitely a good cause to be supporting. What are kind of your plans for the future? I mean, if I gave you a magic wand and said you have the 50K, the money came in and you can build this into exactly what you want it to look like, what does your neighborhood look like 5 years from now?
5 years from now, we have a functional nonprofit urban farm with a 10,000 fish aquaponics system, some high tunnels, a farm manager that's hired and he's running the thing and he's creating his own income with the produce he has there. We're able to put hundreds of volunteers to work also. So, you know, that alone is going to just blast it forward. And we'll have the start of a community cafe. We're already sort of a tourist attraction, but we think we can, you know, draw in a trendy crowd to come to our coffee shop, and there's a marketplace right there for our fresh vegetables. And that kind of action, that kind of momentum forward changes everything. So that's going to be what you see on the outside. On the inside, you're going to see kids whose lives are taking a new path.
You know, as I look at this, I think about the work that I try to do every day, and I try to tell people that, yes, you know, that our name is the Survival Podcast, and we do prepare for disaster, we prepare for emergencies. And we look at things like our current economy, and we realize the ineptitude of government, and we realize that there could be anything from a natural disaster to a man-made catastrophe. But most people that come to that mindset initially come to it with a very outsider's view of I need to take care of myself and I need to store food and I need to have all these supplies and there's a place for that. But if you look at it the way you would, let's say if you called a fire chief or somebody out to your house and said, tell me what to do if my house catches on fire. What plan should I have to get people out of the house? How should, you know, set that up for me and help me put it together? He'd say, great, I'm happy to help you do that. But first I'm going to give you 20 ways to set this up so that the house doesn't catch on fire in the first place and to prevent the fire. And then I'm going to give you some things you need to have in place so if a fire starts and it's minor, you can put it out yourself before your whole house is engulfed. And then if those things fail, then we'll fall back to here's how everybody gets out. And I think if we start doing more and more things like you're doing, these things like food shortages and economic crises and things like that, when they do occur, because they're going to happen, it's like having a fire retardant sprayed on your house. Yeah, there's some flame, but not necessarily everything goes up in smoke. And this is not just a better way to live, which is what we're all about here, but a highly preventative measure from spiraling down into an abyss from which there is no return.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and no doubt we've got people on the ground about 100 miles, you know, out from Kansas City who are kicking butt, growing lots of, you know, food, who are farming, who are just, you know, ready out there. And they're with us, you know, in a time of need, they'd help us. But we want to be a breadbasket ourselves. We see just a ton of resources, a ton of land. Heck, I've got 5 acres, you know, two streets over that used to be a housing area that can totally be turned into agricultural. There's just a lot of way to turn it down, turn it around from the inside here too.
You know, and that's what I wanted to kind of finish up asking you about. Do you guys see this as like, okay, this is what you're doing and this is your community and this is where you're taking your stand. But it seems to me you're doing so much to, like, you're not hiding any of your knowledge or anything you're doing, you're documenting, you're showing, you're giving it away freely. Do you want to see this kind of like islands like you popping up all over? Is that really the bigger goal?
Absolutely. We want to empower people all together. And, you know, it takes money to do that. If, you know, if I don't find a way to get sustainable, then I'll be busy in the 9-to-5 and we're not sharing any information, but, you know, find a way to do both, find a way to empower people. And, you know, cause charity just isn't sustainable, but find a way to do both.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. Well, Jason, I mean, I can't thank you and the other 19 families and your own family enough for what you guys are doing, the information you're sharing, the work you're doing, the results you're having. And I'll tell you, you have a friend in the entire community of the Survival Podcast. And whenever you have something new or an initiative or anything, or if you just want to come back on and talk about stuff you didn't think of today, let me know. You are always welcome here.
Jack, thanks so much, man. It's been awesome hanging out with you, talking with you. Next time I got to bring some of my pals on.
Oh, I'd love that. I'd love that. Oh, one more thing I want to ask you, and I almost forgot. I have people all the time emailing me and saying things like, I'm trying to figure out how to financially afford that homestead, you know, that 2 acres, 5 acres, 10 acres. And a lot of times the conflict is, well, I have a really good paying job in the city, but if I find something out in the country, it's too far away to make the commute, and then I can't make the money anymore. It sounds like if people really put their nose to the grindstone and are willing to make some sacrifices, there's a lot of affordable land real close to these cities where these people are working, and maybe instead of driving through there, if you want to bite the bullet, it could become, if you'll turn it around, a good place to live.
Yeah, the land here is dirt cheap. I mean, we're picking up lots for $500 a piece. And you don't want to do this alone, and you want to do your homework because, you know, five drug dealers versus one is difficult. But if you only have one drug dealer to kick off your block, and you and another family have bought a house, and you get involved in the neighborhood association, and you're moving forward, it's a lot easier.
Yeah, I think there is strength in numbers. Well, again, Jason, thank you for taking the time today to come on the show.
Jack, thanks a lot.
All right, folks, and with that, we have wrapped up today. And this has been Jack Spierko today, along with Jason Fields of the UrbanFarmingGuys.com, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
Seeing our food these days, you know it's on our TVs.
Well, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Survival Podcast, Friday Flashbacks. If you enjoyed today's show, please consider becoming an MSB member. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. You can also support our show by going to TSPAZ, that's T-S-P-A-Z, TSPAZ.com. Anytime you shop online, and while you'll support us no matter what you buy, you will find over 500 reviews of items I have personally tested and vouched for. And to stay in touch with us and never miss anything, follow our channel or our group on Telegram. You can find links to that and all our social media options. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and check the show notes for any episode.